Welcome to
the Grafters Podcast,
brought to you by Reanimate Performance
and the Heavy Metal Strength Coach.
Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of the Grafters Podcast. I am Chris, the Heavy Metal Strength Coach, and it brings me great pleasure to announce my guest this week, which is Laurie Shaw. Laurie is an RP Strength recipe developer. She is a podcaster, an author, a host of her own YouTube show. She is a mother and also a proud gym rat. Now, Laurie, would that introduction be okay with you?
That sounds great. Thank you. I think you got it all.
Perfect. I always get really nervous about introductions because sometimes I've missed like half the qualifications out, just made up some jobs that they have and things like that. So I'm glad I've got it right today. So yeah.
Yes, you did.
So Laurie, when did you get involved with Renaissance periodization? Were you there right from the beginning or did you come in a little bit later down the line?
So my husband started RP, and at first that was his gig and I had my own gig. I was working in corporate America. Yeah. So we did that for a while and, he was getting to the point where he was, the RP was really growing. He was going to need to hire some help. And at the same time, I had just moved to a different job and was 6 months in and was really miserable and hated it. So we were like, okay, the timing makes sense for us to try this. So let's try it. And if we end up hating each other, then I'll go get a real job. and so that was, 4 or 5 years ago now, I guess.
Yeah.
It's all worked out great.
That's amazing. So how long into the process did you start creating those recipes?
Pretty much right off the bat. I mean, when I started, I think I started like in the fall. It was maybe like September or something like that. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things, I mean, I've just always loved to cook and bake. Just my mom is a great cook and baker. And I just grew up in the kitchen with her. And I've always just, it's always been a huge passion of mine, but I was never really able to turn it into a job. I went to culinary school for a little bit, but knew I didn't want to work crazy hours in restaurants while everybody else was having fun, being in a restaurant, late nights, holidays, all that. I knew that wasn't for me. But I always loved to cook. And so when I started working with Nick, I said, man, I think that your people need to know that dieting is not about like dry chicken, rice, and steamed broccoli. Although Nick would probably happily eat that every meal of every day of his life. He's probably fine with that. But for those of us who might want a little bit of flavor, I was like, wow, I really think maybe we should try a cookbook. And he's like, yeah, it can't hurt. Let's just see what happens. And so, we released that one in the summer. So I started working on it at the end of the year and finished it like in 6 months. And we got it out in the summer. I don't know what year that was. But anyway, and now we've done 6 cookbooks and I'm working on the 7th. And they've gone over great. People just really love to see different ideas that you can still eat macro friendly, but have, really great flavor.
Yeah. Do you find athletes, bodybuilders that get these cookbooks that then essentially learn to cook through them become more empowered in the process? Do you think that's, is that a process that you've seen?
Yes, 100%. And especially right now, during quarantine, where people, might not have had time to cook, or just have just been way too busy with other things. Now they're like, okay, kind of sitting here at home. What should I do? I've got these cookbooks, maybe I should start doing it. And then all of a sudden they discover like they have a real passion for it. And they're working their way through the books and stuff. So ironically, the quarantine has really kind of brought about renewed interest in the cookbooks, and people are posting lots of pictures. And I love seeing when people make the recipes or people comment and tell me which ones they like the best and all that stuff. So I've seen a ton of that here in the past few difficult months.
Yeah. Now I know that you're a mother as well. Do you cook with the children? Are you planning on passing all those cooking skills onto those?
I'm trying. I think I started trying a little bit too early. Yeah. They're 6 and 8 now. And I started trying when they were really little. And I think that was probably too early. So at this point, you know, as long as it's something fairly simple, they still have a fairly short attention span, but as long as it's something fairly simple and specifically a dessert, if it's a dessert, then they're all for it to help. Yeah. So I'll take their help whenever they're willing to give it. But sometimes they're not all that interested. If it's maybe more of a savory dish, they're like, oh, can we just make cookies or muffins or something?
Yeah.
And then they'll help me.
That's amazing. So my partner does nutritional templates for people, and I'm lucky enough that she trained as a chef and puts all these recipes together for my client and things, and clients even. And her clients often come back and say this particular gnocchi dish that she does comes back, and people are always saying it's wonderful. Can I have that on my template? I know this might be putting you on the spot a little bit, but are there any recipes that you can think of where clients are always coming back saying that that is absolutely amazing? Please put it into every single one of my templates.
See, so the way our templates work, we actually don't put in specific recipes or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So you have your templates and you have your macros. And then my cookbook lists out the macros for each ingredient in the recipe and then the macros for the recipe as a whole. Mm-hmm. So people can kind of flip through the cookbook and find which recipes fit into the templates, to the macros on their specific template. So that's kind of how ours work. Mm-hmm. But hands down, the most popular recipe of all 6 cookbooks are our turkey enchiladas.
Okay.
So they're super easy to put together. They're a great one for kids to help with. You bake it in like a casserole dish, so it makes a lot of portions, and it's just easy. You just kind of throw it all together, throw it in the oven, and then it's a pretty good meal prep type of thing, because then you've got additional portions there for you. But we have had a ton of people say, like, their whole family loves it, which is always my favorite. When somebody says, like, oh my gosh, my husband who isn't even dieting, and my kids who of course aren't dieting, you know, absolutely love these recipes. So if you can make something that fits into your diet, but also serves your whole family for dinner, like, that's a huge win, because it's difficult trying to make something for the rest of your family and then something just for you because you're dieting. Like, that kind of stinks. Yeah. That's like cooking twice.
That's awesome. And you have 6 books now.
Yes.
Has the way that you put those together evolved over time, or did you instantly find what works and stuck with that?
You know what? It has definitely evolved. The first one we did, I really tried to tie it 100% into the templates. The templates are organized. You've got your protein. At the time, these were paper templates. Now we have an app, but the paper templates organized, you know, so here are your lean proteins, here are your healthy carbs, your vegetables, your healthy fats. So I basically went through, so the first cookbook was 100 recipes, and it was divided up between all of those categories. So it tied, you know, right into the cookbook. And then my second one that I did was very similar to that. It was 100 recipes. But for me to write a 100 recipe cookbook, it takes about a year. So everybody was like, okay, every time we release a cookbook, it sells like crazy. So we need you to do them faster.
So then
I started doing smaller 50 recipe cookbooks that were a little bit more specialized, because I figured at this point everybody has 200 very general recipes, so let's start doing like more specialized ones. So I did a 50 recipe vegan cookbook, which our vegan athletes were really asking for, and that has gone over really well.
Excellent.
I did a 50 recipe book that is only sweets for all of my fellow sweet tooth dieters out there. So all macro friendly, but all of them have a sweet angle to them. So 50 of those. We did 50 in a cookbook called Let's Party, which is basically recipes that you can make when you're entertaining. So if you're having people over for something, but you still want to stick to your macros, these are all dishes that, you know, I think people wouldn't be able to tell that they're diet recipes, but you could stay on track and you could still serve this to a group of people for a party or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the other one I'm blanking on right now, my fourth 50 recipe cookbook.
There's too many books to remember. That's
right. Yes. So anyway, that's how everything evolved. We started cranking out 50 recipe books just to get them out more often, so we could do 2 a year. But now I'm kind of going backwards, because the 7th one is my first one that's going to be traditionally published. So the first 6 we self-published. So I wrote all of those. I have somebody locally that turns it into a book for me, and then we can get it out immediately. But this is the first one that I'm doing. This next one is going to be traditionally published. So it'll be on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that kind of stuff. And that's going to be more back to those first two. It'll be a broader type of general purpose cookbook, and it'll probably have 120 recipes this time. So that's what number 7 will be.
Okay. And was that decision just to reach more people, or just to say that you have published one, I guess properly, or just to tick it off the bucket list? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was kind of a bucket list thing for me, to be honest. You know, the way that we do it works great for us, and and we can really get them out much faster. So yeah, it was, I go to this super fun food conference every year, except for this year, of course, but every year in Utah. And I sat in, and it's all for food bloggers, recipe developers. It's just this huge conference that's super fun. It's like 3 days, and you can sit in on different presentations by different people. And I sat in on a presentation by a literary agent for cookbook authors. So I sat in on the presentation, and, you know, sat there, and she went through a whole what you would do if you were pitching a book and that kind of thing. And I just was like, oh my gosh, I really want to do this. So I came home and told Nick, like, I really want to try to get a book published, like a really legitimate cookbook published. Yeah. So that's what we're doing. So we're in the process of it, and we'll see how it goes. If it turns out to be something that, you know, is a really frustrating process, I might go back to the way we've been doing it.
Well, it's great that you've got that to fall back on if you do need
yes,
to. You guys,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, the RP books look fantastic anyway. So
thank you.
They always look like they're properly published anyway. So
thank you very much.
Just wanted to drop that in there. And on your Instagram bio, it says that you are a gym rat. Yes. I wondered if you just explain that a little bit and just see where you've got in the gym, what you've done, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. I think when I say gym rat, it just means that I love being in the gym. It's some place that I've lifted since high school, which was a long time ago. And, you didn't see a whole lot of females in the gym when I started lifting in high school. And I lifted through college. And again, nothing really, I probably didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't following any programs. I wasn't trying to compete or anything like that. Honestly, it was for vanity and health more than anything else. And then I just continued on. And when I met Dr. Mike Isertel and Nick, I was living in New York City and had just joined a personal training gym, and they were both working there. And I was randomly assigned to Dr. Mike Isertel as my trainer. And I've told this story before. I walk into this gym, and there's all these, you know, really like super jacked cut trainers everywhere. And I'm like waiting to see who my trainer is going to be. And like Dr. Mike walks up. And if you've ever met Dr. Mike, I mean, he's like, I don't know, 5 foot something and like very, very wide guy. And I'm like, oh, great. Like they give me like, you know, the overweight trainer. Oh, that's just great. I've told him that. Everybody knows that story. I swear he won't be offended because I've told it to
him. No, totally. I'm the exact same height as Mike as well. And I've lifted weights for a long time. So just thinking there's other trainers out there like me is perfect.
Yeah. So I started training with Dr. Mike, and he was like, you know, you should really compete. You should compete in figure. And I was like, I don't know what that is. I had no idea what physique sports were or anything like that. And he was like, I really think that you should compete in figure. So I was like, okay. And so I trained for my first show. And then I ended up doing, I think, 4 shows total in between, you know, getting married and having babies. So I competed once and then got married, had a baby, got back into shape, competed twice, had another baby, and then got back in shape and competed again. So just 4 different times. But that was interesting, but I have definitely officially retired from physique sports, so I would not be interested in competing again.
Yeah. Did your experience competing dictate how you put these recipes together and how you would tell another person how to cook as a bodybuilder or a figure competitor?
You know, I mean, again, it's pretty much the same principle of like, you know, going through the cookbook and seeing which recipes kind of fit the macros that you're trying to follow to diet down.
So,
I mean, I pretty much can't write cookbooks when I'm dieting because, you know, it involves a lot of tasting and sampling and redoing and sampling again and all that stuff. And when I'm on, when I was on super, super strict macros to try to get down to that type of body fat percentage. I mean, my last show, I got to 10% body fat. And at that point, like, there was no room for tasting or sampling or anything. So I pretty much put the cookbook, I tried to time the cookbooks so that I would be able to recipe test and work on writing a cookbook when I was massing or on maintenance or right after a show or something like that when I had a lot more wiggle room.
Do you think that after a long prep, your food sensitivity just builds and builds and builds? So just after a competition sounds like the perfect time to put that in place.
Yes. Yes, except that I am terrible at maintenance. I'm terrible at maintenance. Somebody coined the phrase somewhere, gaintenance, and I was like, oh my God, that is what I do. I do not maintain, I gaintain. I usually go, oh, my diet's ended, and just start eating like everything in sight. I'm terrible at maintenance.
I remember after my first bodybuilding show, we went and just demolished about 4 pizzas, 4 desserts. And again, like I'm 5'2", so you could see my stomach for about a week.
Yeah, I know. Did you feel like miserable right after?
Oh, so miserable. I remember the day after that, just laying in the bath, just melancholy. Like not prior to, not in any other way, but just to like, what have I done to myself? You know what I mean? But
I know.
It's an interesting thing because with so many people that have competed, you hear nightmare stories about their first diet, their first prep. So working under Dr. Mike and alongside your husband Nick, do you feel that you were able to navigate a lot of those pitfalls without all the drama? Because that's quite a rare thing in bodybuilding, I've found.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Mike has said that his perfect client is like a super anal retentive person that will like weigh and measure every last thing, and that's me. So, you know, I was basically just like, you know, their robot. You know, whatever they told me to do, I did it. Whatever they told me to do in the gym, I did. Whatever they told me to do in the kitchen, I did. Cardio, I did. It was like, so, you know, it's really funny. We always laugh because back in the early days before RP was really born, because of course I met these guys before RP actually was created. So we were all guinea pigs. I mean, you know, Mike and Nick experimented on themselves and they experimented on me. And so there was definitely, it's cool to see, you know, because everything that they do is based on science, that their recommendations have changed. I mean, they certainly have changed over the years. And some people will get upset about that. Like, well, why did the templates change? Well, because the science has changed. And as new science comes out to show that there's a better way to do things, we will always be updating our products to make sure that we're taking advantage of the latest and greatest in science. So it's interesting to see some of the things that we would have done. I mean, Mike, just always wanted everybody. We always joked that he wants everybody to get really big. He just wants everybody to just eat and eat and eat. So after I competed the first time, he was like, I wanted to compete again. Like I loved it. I mean, you know, I feel like you love it or hate it.
Yeah.
And it's funny because completely. Mike. Yeah. So I feel like Mike and Nick both predicted that I would hate it. They're like, just do that this one time and you'll probably hate it, but you can just say you've done it and you can experience it. I mean, I was on stage that first time and I was like, oh my gosh, like I am completely hooked. I love this.
Yeah. When you were on stage that first time, did you notice that there was anyone in the crowd or did it feel just like it was just you and maybe a couple of judges that you can see?
Yeah, that was it. That was it. Like I just really didn't, it was just all sort of, everything else was, it was actually a pretty big show. It was not a pro qualifier. Mm-hmm. It was a local show, but it was a really big show. It's funny because I've never done a show that was that big again since. It just happened to be my first time out. And so it was pretty overwhelming. I mean, it was an absolutely packed crowd and everything. And yeah, I mean, it was just, yeah, me and the judges, basically. That's how I felt. And yeah, I just absolutely fell in love with the process. But afterwards, Mike was like, okay, so you've done it and we know that you're not big enough. Like, we know you don't have enough muscle. So now, like, you're going to spend like, whatever, a year or something putting on muscle. And I was like, no, I don't want to. I want to compete again. And he's like, well, that's not how it works. You know, we already have seen you. Like, we know where we need to work. Now let me work on you. And like, we'll try to put on what you need and stuff like that. And my impatient personality, I was like, oh, that doesn't sound like very much fun. And I remember at one point, because I had a corporate job and I had like a mini fridge under my desk. And I would take all this food. And I remember at one point I was like, I am almost eating an entire jar of peanut butter a day. Like, I cannot do this. I can't do this. So yeah, it was funny. Just the different things that we experimented with. Back then it was like massing was like full on crazy amounts of food massing. I mean, now their recommendations for massing are much more pulled back, controlled, slower gains, all that stuff. But I mean, Mike and Nick will be the first to tell you, like, oh my gosh, I mean, I have pictures of the two of them like in full mass back in the day, just gigantic human beings. And I mean, they'll be the first to tell you that getting that excess fat off to compete was torture.
Absolutely. I've been there. Like I used to follow the old school of just get as big as you can. And
yeah,
if I get to the mid 80 kilos, then I'm so short that I just look like a football. Yeah. And that was the whole process back then,
yeah,
to get absolutely huge and then diet down and have an awful time doing it, end up with binge eating disorder, and then repeat again from there and think you're healed. But it's thanks to people like Happy, like Dr. Mike, like Nick, that I think you start to see that less and less, unless they are just going by the old school approach.
Yeah.
That bodybuilding has come on so far, and it is just down to people like you. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And I just wondered if you'd say a few words about your YouTube cookery show. How did that come about?
Yeah, so, and we haven't done any recently. So that was something that was just sort of like, I think it was our videographer had come to, actually, who had done a ton of work with Mike and done some lifting videos and that type of thing. And he came to us and said, I think it was right after I don't know which cookbook had just come out, but you know, he came to us and said, like, you know, I've looked at some of the statistics on YouTube, and like the fastest growing area are cooking shows on YouTube. And, you know, he had this whole, like a bunch of statistics on the average number of channels that people subscribe to and how many of them are food related and stuff like that. And we were like, so we looked around and we're like, we don't think there's anybody else out there that's doing healthy cooking shows.
Yeah.
And not like, you know, I mean, they might say, you know, people say like, oh, it's healthy. And that meanwhile, they put like, they start out in a pan with like, they go around the pan like five times with olive oil. Like, this is a healthy recipe, but I've just added like 75 grams of fat into the pan before I even start.
Yep.
So truly, truly more like athlete type of healthy cooking where, you know, I'm going to tell you exactly what the macros are in this, you know, everything that you're putting in it and everything like that. So we decided, so he was like, I really think that there's, you know, a market for this. So I was like, yeah, I'm all for it. I love this. I, you know, put me behind the camera and talking about food and it's my happy place.
Yeah.
So I was like, let's do this. And so the problem, it was very interesting because the problem is that, so our videographer was like, okay, well, my one absolute that we have to have is like a cooktop in the island of the kitchen, because like my cooktop, my stove faces a wall. And so he was like, I can't keep moving the camera back and forth. So that means we couldn't use my house. So we went on like Airbnb. I went on Airbnb and found a house in Charlotte that had an island cooktop, and we rented it for like 4 days. I packed up my entire kitchen, drove it 30 minutes to this house, unpacked the entire thing. And we spent like 2.5 days and recorded like 38 videos in like 2.5 days, and then packed it all up again and drove it back home. And I was like, I will never do this again.
Well, that's definitely my next question answered, whether there was going to be any repeats of that. Now, what I wanted to get into now is, I'm guessing, a very difficult stage of your life that you are currently passing through. And my understanding is a few months ago, you were diagnosed with breast cancer and just finished chemotherapy. I'm just wondering if we could just spend some time talking about initially when you were diagnosed, and then I've got a few questions about that, and then we can go from there.
Yep, sure. So it was last year in September, I had a pain in my armpit, and it just came on all of a sudden over a weekend. It was like a Saturday morning. I was like, wow, that's really weird. I probably did something in the gym. That's what I thought. And it just stuck with me through that whole weekend. And it was just really a nagging pain in my armpit. So I started kind of feeling around like, what the heck did I do there? And I just really thought I had pulled a muscle or something like that. And then I found like a little tiny little, you know, I don't know, I wouldn't even call it a lump because it was too small, but it was like a little BB or pebble feeling or whatever. I'm like, that's weird. And I just happened to have a doctor's appointment a couple days later. And I told my doctor, I was like, yeah, I found this thing. And she said, oh, do you want me to do an exam? And I said, yeah, that would be great. And so, you know, she ordered an ultrasound. And then unfortunately, my doctor's office and my healthcare system that we have insurance through argued back and forth for like 6 weeks to say whether or not I needed to, because I had just had a 100% clean mammogram 5 months prior. So my doctor wanted an ultrasound. She knew that it was far enough in my armpit, it would not show up on a mammogram. She did not want me to repeat a mammogram. But the healthcare system said, you know, it's a black and white rule. If you haven't had a mammogram in 3 months and you find something, you have to repeat it. So unfortunately, like they argued back and forth for, so I lost 6 weeks of time, which is, you know, and again, like I was really busy with the kids and gearing up for the holidays and doing all this stuff. And I was like, oh, it's nothing, you know? So of course, you know, looking back, of course I would have wanted to have gotten in there quicker. But by the time they got to scheduling me, it was December, and they're like, we have nothing. We have no open appointments. So I didn't get in until January. So I found this in September, didn't get in until January for a full scan, biopsy and everything. And then was diagnosed in January.
Okay. So what was it like when you got that initial diagnosis? Was it something where you were like, right, yeah, let's fight this? Or is it something where it's like, well, I don't know how to respond to this and I'm going to hide away? Was it something between the two?
I mean, it knocked me completely down. I mean, it's just something that you never see coming, but specifically me, I mean, I have no family history. I am not at the common, I'm younger than when they typically find it. Mm-hmm. I am super healthy. I have been healthy my entire life. I have, you know, eaten healthy, exercised. I mean, I did everything right. And so it's just one of those things. I mean, nobody ever thinks it's going to happen to them. But at least if you have a family history, I mean, I've had talked to some women that are like, I knew I was waiting for it. My entire family, every woman, you know, in my family had breast cancer, something like that. But for me, I mean, with no family history, it wasn't even on my radar. I mean, it just wasn't on my radar at all. So it really knocked me flat down, and Nick too. I mean, we just couldn't believe it. And in the beginning, it's kind of like the bad news just keeps coming, because there's one is the diagnosis. And they're like, well, you know, we've caught it really early. And so, you know, and if it's, there's, you know, there's like three different kinds. And if it's these two kinds, then we know exactly, you know, how, what type of drug to give you so that we know it, you know, it'll never come back. And, you know, and it might not require chemo and that type of thing. And so, of course, by the time I had surgery and everything, we realized mine was the third type, which they don't know as much about. So there aren't these, you know, there isn't some drug I can take the rest of my life and make sure it doesn't come back. And, you know, I had to have chemotherapy. And so, you know, like the day you're diagnosed is devastating. And then the day that you find out you're going to lose all your hair is kind of devastating. And then the day that you find out what type you have is kind of devastating. I mean, so it was like a series of devastating phone calls and doctor's appointments in the beginning.
And then how did it progress from there as you started to be treated? Did it still feel like constant bad news, or did you start to think, well, I can start to approach this methodically, I can have goals for getting through this? Did it start to make sense almost?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about this a lot, that I really kind of, I consider it a grieving process. I let myself really grieve. I cried every single day in the beginning. And I didn't want to do that in front of my kids, but I would cry in the closet or the laundry room or the bathroom or whatever. Like, you know, I let myself go through all, I mean, I just would have moments where I was like, I just can't believe this. Every time somebody would call and say, oh, this is the Cancer Institute of blah, blah, blah. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm talking to, you know, a cancer institute. So, you know, I let myself go through all of that and, you know, really process everything. But at some point, like, I am a planner, and at some point I crossed this line to like, okay, this is it. And this is what's happening. And so I just switched kind of into planning mode. And, you know, it was like, all right, so chemo is going to start here and go to here. And, you know, I just went into planning mode, and I had a decision to make about whether or not to go public or to just disappear. Like, we're a pretty private family. Yeah. And I, you know, I almost just like shut down my social media and just disappeared. And I gave myself a few days to think about it. And I was like, you know what? My story, I think, is helpful, you know, from the sense of just, again, my age, the fact that I'm healthy, that I have no family history, all that stuff. Like, I feel like I need to tell this. I think I can help people. And yeah. So I decided if I could help one person, it was worth coming out and, you know, talking about this on social media. So I went on Instagram, I told everybody, and I was like, you know, the one thing I'm super focused on is staying positive. And I want all the positivity that you can send me, like books, movies, podcasts, like tell me your favorite uplifting, positive type of stuff, because I know that that can make a difference in how patients, you know, get better. There is definitely science that shows that a positive attitude makes a difference. So I wanted to overwhelm myself with positivity. And so I started meditating and, you know, just really started to try to just do everything positive. And Nick is right there with me. And we just, that was kind of the point where we're like, okay, this is happening. And we're not going to go cry in the corner anymore. We've switched over into like, yes, you know, we can get through this. And that's just kind of how we changed the mindset.
Yeah. Thank you for that answer. I have a client who currently has incurable breast cancer that has essentially spread throughout her body. And she actually started, well, to go a little bit further back, she trained with me, went away, came back, and she had the incurable cancer at that time. And she said that she was looking at statistics and saw that so many people stop training and stop exercising once they get that diagnosis. And she didn't want to be one of those statistics that just end up getting weaker and weaker. And now she's in the gym, she's training with me a couple of times a week. I'm just wondering, like, how your relationship with exercise changed over this time, where you were being treated and still being treated, and whether you would recommend other people get into the gym and still try and do things.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I was really focused. My oncologist, who I love, you know, told me in the very beginning, you see, first of all, I asked, you know, can I lift during chemo? And everyone kind of looks at you like, what? What did you say? Yeah. You know, can you lift a fork or what do you mean lift? And I was like, yeah, lift heavy weights. And everyone's like, you know, I'm not, she said, you don't have any physical restriction, do what you want to do. But she said, I'll just tell you this. You seem like a person that will push through things. And I don't want you pushing through things when you're doing chemo, because we don't want you getting just super fatigued and all that stuff. The drugs alone are fatiguing enough. So I had talked to enough people that I was really like, okay, I'm just going to be really good to myself. So I was really tired. I mean, there is a lot of fatigue that comes from it. I had a lot of GI problems from it and everything like that. So I thought I was being really good to myself. So I really just, I mean, I probably lifted 4 or 5 times in the 5 months that I was doing chemo. I was walking, I would go for a walk outside, that type of thing, but I didn't really lift. And I have to say, looking back, I probably would have done it differently. I would have tried to stay in the gym. I mean, now that I am finished with chemo, I finished chemo on a Monday, had a party with my family on Tuesday, and on Wednesday started a training program and a diet program.
Oh, that's amazing. So how did you go about planning that training program and initially setting those goals again once that treatment was finished?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I would start to get everything, you know, my energy back and everything like that back. And I mean, I had eaten terribly during chemo. Again, talk about this like being good to myself thing. I mean, a lot of food just don't taste good. My taste buds were just gone. Even though I knew what something was supposed to taste like, it didn't taste like that. So I just started eating whatever tasted good, which a lot of times was like chips and chocolate. And so, I mean, I put on like decent amount of weight during chemo, and I knew that is not healthy for me. So I knew that I wanted to get that off as soon as I had my taste buds back and my energy back and everything like that. So I'm doing the simplified training templates with RP, and I'm doing the RP diet app. And so I'm like 3 weeks into that now.
Okay. And do you have any goals at the end of it where you would like to, where you'd like to get to, or any weights that you'd like to lift, or is it just a matter of getting back into it and achieving that consistency again and being healthy?
Yeah, it really is. It is about that. I mean, I definitely want to have some body composition change. I mean, I think the average is like 15% muscle lost over the course of chemo. So I know I've lost muscle. I know I've added fat. You know, I don't even know what that looks like just yet in terms of a number on the scale that I want to get to, but I just know the body comp that I want to get to.
Yeah.
I feel so good being back in the gym and lifting 4 days a week and all of that. And there's a super interesting study that an RP coach just sent to me of work that they're doing, I think it's in Australia, with cancer patients. And they actually have them doing chemo in the morning and going to the gym and training with trainers in the afternoon. And they have found that their recovery from chemo, they have a lot fewer side effects, they have fewer fatigue. And there are even like some targeted like upper body type of movements that they're doing. They even think that if somebody has a tumor, my tumor was removed in surgery prior to doing chemo, but for somebody that has a tumor, there's even supposed to be, you know, some targeted upper body type of movements. I guess one of the things about a tumor is that the blood flow around it is not very good. So by lifting, you're increasing the blood flow, which will travel, you know, allow the chemo drugs to actually travel to the tumor more effectively.
Wow.
So it's pretty amazing stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. That's incredible. I definitely need to read that study. And something that I was talking to my client about was how people interacted with her. And whenever I talk to her, I don't want to skirt around the topic of cancer, like pretend that I'm like avoiding this thing and walking on eggshells.
Yes.
I wonder how you like people to talk to you about it, and whether it got under your skin when they were just pretending that this big C word wasn't even in the picture.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's really hard to have people uncomfortable around you. So I would much prefer that somebody just talk about the elephant in the room. Because it makes me feel really uncomfortable when someone's really uncomfortable. And I actually was training before the quarantine and everything. I was actually training in a gym with a trainer, and his mom had just gone through chemo and treatment for cancer and everything. And so when I told him, I mean, he always talked about it with me. He was very straightforward, and I really appreciated that a lot.
Yeah. Have you ever been able to laugh at the cancer?
The only thing, I guess, was just the irony again. Like, I keep saying it, but just, you know, I mean, you make plans, you think you're doing everything right, and then life just throws you this crazy curveball. And yeah. So, I mean, that's sometimes I've had moments like that where it's like somebody said to me like once, you know, man, don't you just wish you would have like eaten more cheeseburgers, because it didn't make a difference that you were so healthy and everything. And I wouldn't do that because I still believe that, you know, being healthy is really important. But I just have had moments where I was like, wow, just. And I remember sitting in a doctor's office and him going through this checklist and asking me all these things. Do you drink? No. Do you do this? No. Do you do this? Do you exercise? Yes. He was like, of course you did everything right. Of course you did. And you still have this. So, I mean, more like an irony, but I wouldn't say laughter just yet. Maybe after I've passed the 5-year mark of nothing.
Yeah.
Then I'll be having a huge party.
Yeah. In conversation with my client as well, I think the most spectacularly stupid thing someone said to her was, oh, well, I've always wanted to shave my head. and you're just like, now I wonder if anyone has said anything. You don't have to name names, I promise. Whether anyone has said anything spectacularly stupid like that that's made you just step back and think, wow, people really don't know how to communicate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was people, again, like really well-meaning people, but people telling me to just brace for the worst, you know, in chemo. Like, you know, I had somebody tell me, you know, oh, you probably will have days where you can't even brush your teeth. So, you know, and I had somebody say to Nick, actually, you know, Nick, you are going to need to be Lori's advocate because she won't be, like, you know, mentally able to advocate for herself. I was just like, we were like, what the heck am I supposed to do with that? This is before I start chemo. Like, are you telling me that I'm going to be like some type of vegetable? Like, I have little kids, you know, I can't do that. I'm not going to be curled up somewhere for 4 months going through chemo. Like, so it was just like really terrible statements like that, that somebody would make. And you're just like, why would you say that to me? Yeah. You know? So just a couple things like that.
So if you were to talk to someone that's about to go into chemotherapy for a condition either the same or similar to yours, what would you be saying to them? What could they expect? How are they going? I know everyone's different, but in general, how are they going to feel and how are they going to respond?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many different side effects and so many people respond differently. And I honestly had probably like all of the side effects, just not continuously. I would have like 1 week where I had mouth sores and, you know, and that was the only time that I had them. And then towards the end, I had terrible GI type of issues. And I didn't have that in the beginning. So just like depending on, and I had three different kinds of drugs. I had two in the beginning and then one at the end. And so those all have different side effects. But I would just say the more water you can drink. I mean, the doctors told me to drink 100 ounces of water on the day of my chemo and like the 2 or 3 days after. And so I found these like 100 ounce jugs. And, 'cause I was like determined again, like the anal retentive me was like, I'm going to drink my 100 ounces. And I don't want to be like guessing like, oh, I probably have had 100 ounces. Like, no, I want to know I've had my 100 ounces. So I would drag this giant thing around and have my 100 ounces of water. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if there was a day where I didn't, I always felt worse at night. So I really think just like that stuff is very strong. And that's an understatement. And you want it to do what it's in there to do. And then you want to get it out of your body. So just to drink as much water as you can.
Yeah. And did the treatment, so you must have been incredibly nervous going into that first treatment because of what people had said. So when you came out and you could move a little bit, was it almost like, okay, well, it's not that bad.
Yes.
And so then did it get better over time when you knew what to expect?
Yeah, I swear. That's what I said. Like every time I got past a first of something, I felt infinitely better, right? Like, you know, the first time that I had to have, chemo. I mean, Nick drove me. So of course, I was going through chemo during quarantine. So he was only able to go with me for the very first one. And after that, I had to go by myself. I drove myself, had to go by myself for every other one. But I remember pulling out of the driveway the first day, and I'm just crying behind my sunglasses, you know, because Nick like reached over and gave me a squeeze or something like that. And I'm just crying behind my sunglasses. I'm like, again, just having a moment where it's like, I can't believe this is where we're going today. I can't believe I'm doing this today. I don't know, you know, how terrible this is. I mean, I had had some iron infusions like a few months back and they were given in a chemo center. So I was, and I remember telling Nick, you know, how terrible it was to sit there and I'm there super healthy getting my iron infusion and everybody else is getting chemo for cancer. And just, you know, I said, oh my God, there's a trash can by every chair. I guess that's if you throw up and, you know, all this stuff. I mean, I'm having like these, just, I'm terrified for that first one. And then afterwards, and especially because I really had to kind of man up and go on my own after that every single time, I was like, okay, I just started to switch to the positive. All right. So this is like 4 hours that I'm going to be there by myself. Like, what do I want to do? You know, I'm going to listen to these podcasts. I'm going to read these books. I'm going to take this magazine and flip through it. I'm going to watch this movie I never got a chance to watch. Like, I started to plan for it and be like, okay, you know, I can watch two Jumanji movies at my next chemo. So yeah, I just started to try to focus on the positive, and it really, like, you know, and the doctor's just saying, like, wow, you're just doing great and your numbers are great and all that stuff. And so I was like, yeah, I got this. I can do this. So just getting over that first hurdle, it's terrifying. And there's nothing anybody can say to you to make it not terrifying in the beginning. Mm-hmm.
So I guess it is about just reassuring people that are going for that first treatment that I'm guessing literally as soon as that treatment has finished and they're able to kind of stand up and to kind of function, it's like, okay, well, it's not just instantly going to be me flawed and not able to do anything. Right. Did you carry on working and doing projects and working towards things, or did you just completely stop while the treatment was ongoing?
No, I kept going. I mean, I do some financial stuff for RP, and there was some talk early on, like, okay, well, we know there are people that could jump in and do this for you if you wanted to. And I was like, okay, well, let me just see. Again, I have these words in my ear of, you know, not being like mentally, you know, capable of doing things or whatever. I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this stuff or not, but let's just see. And of course, I was totally fine continuing to do that type of stuff. The cookbook was interesting because, of course, I couldn't taste anything. So I was like, okay, well, I can't recipe test now, or something that tastes good to me is going to be like, oh my gosh, who made this? You know? But I was able to focus on sort of like the paper part of it, like looking through a lot of cookbooks and, you know, getting ideas of flavor combinations that I wanted to try, and just making lots of notes so that once I had my taste buds back, I would be ready to just start cooking. So I was able to do a lot of like the paper type of stuff for the next cookbook while I was in treatment.
So for someone that's always loved food and always loved to cook, was losing your sense of taste a difficult thing to go through? Was it something that was a big impact, or was it something that you knew would return and you were just able to say, well, I'll just have it so that everything tastes like cardboard for a while?
No, I wish I could say that I had a really good attitude about it, but no, I was having a pity party for myself on the daily. Because yeah, for me, I mean, food flavor is everything. And I honestly think that's why I ended up overeating, because I was like, I can fix this. No, I can do this. I'm going to add more spice, or like, I'm going to try this food, or I'm going to try that. Like, I'm going to find something that tastes good to me. And so I just kept kind of shoving food in my mouth, like hoping that I could taste something. So no, it was really mentally difficult for me. I mean, you know, of all the things I could complain about, that seems really dumb. But for somebody like me, it was sad. It was just sad.
It sounds like a really, really big thing, because it was such a big part of your life. Have you found that sense of taste is coming back now? And
yes.
What tastes have you enjoyed reliving the most?
Yeah, it's been fresh fruit. So again, my oncologist had told me, you know, you can eat, because obviously when you eat raw fruit and raw vegetables, you risk, you know, eating some type of bacteria or something like that if it isn't washed properly. And so, you know, probably you could eat something that had a little bit of bacteria on it, like, maybe you'd feel a little weird or whatever, but you wouldn't get sick. But somebody like me that's immune compromised, like that could have me going to urgent care. Like I could be, you know, in a situation where I'd have to go to urgent care or something like that. And I did not want to do that during the quarantine and with everything that's going on. So I chose to avoid all raw fruits and vegetables while I was undergoing chemo. So I would literally wash strawberries and raspberries and blueberries for my kids and put them out and make them smoothies and all this. And I didn't eat any of that. So So Monday will be 4 weeks since my chemo ended, and I still waited like 2.5-3 weeks. So really it's only been for the past week that I'm eating amazing strawberries and raspberries and blueberries and peaches and all of the fresh fruit. Yeah. So that's been awesome.
Did the taste as good as you remembered?
Better.
Wait, oh, they must give you such a and you found appreciation of every single taste that's just been turned right down. Now, I can just tell by the big smile that's on your face now. That's
Now,
at this point in the podcast, what I like to do is just ask people about any mentors that have influenced their life in some way. It might be people that are mentioned on podcasts and YouTube and social media all the time, or it might be people that aren't mentioned like that. And if you just want to just give anyone a shout out, then the floor is yours, Laurie.
All right. You know, I would say, especially, you know, through this recent challenge that I've had with breast cancer, I mean, there were two women, and again, these aren't people that you would know from social media or anything, that were just amazing with answering my billion questions and giving me advice on different things and, you know, checking in on me all the time. And I mean, those two women will just never know what that has meant to me. It's just been everything. You know, I could just tell them, like, I'm just really pissed off. This is happening to me. And, you know, they understand because they've been through it. These were women that have gone through breast cancer. And so, you know, that is something that, you know, has just really impacted me a lot in these recent months. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Nick and Mike, I mean, you know, just meeting them, both of them have changed my life in so many ways. And, you know, just watching Nick evolve, I guess, as a husband and father and everything like that is amazing. He's very focused on making himself the best version that he can of himself. And so that's really wonderful to see and to have my children see. He's just such a great example for them. And, you know, Dr. Mike is just awesome because he's just always upbeat. I mean, I had a phone call with him right after my diagnosis and he was like, you know, can you talk? And I was like, well, I'm probably going to be crying because this was like really early. And he's like, oh no, stop. You're not going to cry. And he called me and I was like, and I was in my car. So I have him on speaker. And I mean, I think he said like, I forget what term he kept using. I think it was like kick the bucket or something. He just kept saying like, listen, I mean, if you're going to kick the bucket, I mean, do you want to like be sad about it up until you kick the bucket? Or do you, you know, want to like, you live the best life you can up until then? And he just kept going through, but he kept using this phrase. I'm like, okay, I'd really like for you to stop talking about me kicking the bucket. I get the point. So yeah, I mean, his attitude on life in general is just amazing to think like he just, I swear that he should do stand-up comedy. He should do motivational speaking. I really think that our app should have like motivational sound bites from Mike that will just pop up when things are bad. He can just be like, okay, shut up. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. Like you can do this, you know, you can definitely do this or whatever. I mean, we should just have those in there. So yeah, all of those people I would say come to mind.
Yeah, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. And for anyone that wants to find out more about you or RP or anything like that, where would people go to find out more?
Yeah, so we have a website, rpstrength.com, and all my cookbooks are there and all of our diet templates and training templates are there. And then we have the RP Diet app. And then on Instagram, we are at rpstrength, and then mine is at llshaw and the number one. And then we also have at @RP_transformations where our clients post their before and after transformations. So I think those are the big ones. And then Facebook also, RP Strength on Facebook.
Okay. Laurie Shaw, thank you for joining us. It has been lovely to have you on today.
Thank you so much.